Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin and how did they end? Let's find out on Fan of History.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Well, we have another special guest today, don't we? I would like to introduce a fan of history, Enkidu. He's also from Sweden, like Dan, and he's going to talk to us today about the Epic of Gilgamesh. So, Enkidu, how about introduce yourself, and then we'll get started.
Yeah, so, hi, Bernie, and thank you very much for letting me join the podcast. I've been listening to it for quite some time, and I'm a huge fan of history. My name is Enkidu, and I'm going to talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh with you, Bernie.
Awesome. That is, I'm so excited about this because, I mean, Enkidu is definitely a very good student on the Epic of Gilgamesh, and then he'll tell you a little bit more about his background, too, why that is. So, actually, yeah, give us a little bit about your background, you know. I mean, Enkidu, that's definitely a Epic of Gilgamesh type name, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'm of Assyrian origin, so that's very much why my father chose to name me Enkidu. So, both my parents are from Mesopotamia. And they come from a place in Mesopotamia that used to be called in Neo-Assyrian times Kashyari, I think. And it's like in modern-day Turkey. And today the area is called Tur Abdin. So, that's a little bit about my background and why my parents chose to name me after character in a very old epic.
Yes. And you live in Sweden, right?
Yeah, I live in Sweden. Same as Dan.
Nice.
And I was brought up here.
Is there a large Assyrian community in Sweden?
It's a big Assyrian community here in Sweden and in other parts of the world as well. I know in the States there are many Assyrians who live there.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got to find them. They'll probably love our podcast.
Yeah,
a lot of stuff about Assyria.
Yeah,
for sure. So we're going to talk about Gilgamesh. And then as I promised in the last podcast I did with Dan on the Library of Ashurbanipal, I wanted to give a little bit more information just on how it was found. Not really how it was found. We covered that physical copy, but just how it was literally found in the British Museum. So I have some notes. I'm going to talk about it, but I'm going to read right from this book that I got from. It's so funny. I got the book from my local library while I'm studying about the Library of Ashurbanipal, and it's called The Buried Book, The Loss and Rediscovery of the Great Epic of Gilgamesh by David Damrosch. It's like from maybe like 2007, something like that. But honest to gosh, it's a really good book. I think I read it twice already. I have to take it back to the library after we do this, record this podcast.
Yeah, I'd really like to look into it because personally, like how the epic was discovered is like that story is just like amazing and it's super interesting.
Totally. Just so amazing. So yeah, I would recommend listen to the other podcast when by the time anybody's hearing that one will be released on the library. So we'll have, the information about the archaeological dig, but I'm going to read a passage from this book. But so the background though is the first guy was Sir Henry Rawlinson. He was, a British, I should say, a classic Victorian character. I mentioned on when I talked to Dan, like, he's just the guy who would be out in the field and say, "Oh, darn, I lost my leg from a tiger. Could you boys go find my leg for me, please?" So he was like that kind of guy, just all these adventures. It's around, starting around 1835, he started, amongst his adventures, as a soldier, he started working on cracking the code of cuneiform. And by 1860, he published his first volume of cuneiform inscriptions. It's called, the first volume of cuneiform inscriptions of Western Asia. He was about 50 years old at the time. And George Smith, now he's our main character here for this part of the topic, he was a young guy, just an engraver. He wasn't a scholar per se or anything, officially a scholar. He was obviously a scholar because in his spare time, he decided to learn how to, translate cuneiform. And they used to let these people come into the museum and a couple days a week, if you weren't, a member or official scholar, and try to help translate these tablets, which is literally like piles of rocks on tables, and they're trying to piece them together and then read them. So like around the 1840s is when they found them, but this is 1872 now. So this is like almost 25 years later, he finds this. So I'm going to just read it right from the book from David Damrosch. No copyright issues here. Here we go. Forgotten for more than 2,000 years, the Epic of Gilgamesh re-entered history on a brisk November day in 1872. Its 12 broken tablets had been mixed in among the 100,000 fragments that Henry Laird and Hormond Rassam had shipped back to London from Nineveh a quarter century before. 100,000 fragments. I mean, really, right? So for years, the epic lay cradled in the crates and drawers of the British Museum's massive collection, while scholars gradually deciphered the tablet's cuneiform script and began to read them. Slowly, an entire world was coming to light as the researchers worked through the huge jumble of materials before them, receipts for oxen, slaves, and casks of wine, petitions to the Assyrian kings, contracts, treaties, prayers, and reports of omens the gods had planted in sheep's livers. Much of this material was of interest to only a handful of specialists, but then an assistant curator named George Smith came upon an electrifying passage. Here we go. Smith was working at a long table piled with tablets in a second floor room overlooking the bare branches of the plane trees in Russell Square. He could read the tiny cuneiform markings only when enough light came through the tall windows. Fearful of fire, the museum's trustees had refused to allow gas lighting in the museum, and in 1872 there was no light bulbs. The museum did supply covered lanterns for a select number of senior staff, but Smith was too junior to enjoy the use of one. So on days of dense London fog, the museum would close and the entire staff would be sent home. So it must have been a clear day when George Smith came upon a piece of tablet whose lines referred to a flood storm, a ship caught on a mountain, and a bird sent out in search of dry land. So you could imagine he was completely amazed, couldn't believe he had, you know, found this after all this time. So continue a little bit here. So now George Smith was onto something truly sensational. It was the first independent confirmation of a vast flood in ancient Mesopotamia, complete with a Noah figure and an ark. Yet he could read only a few lines of the tablet, much of which was encrusted with a thick lime-like deposit. He desperately needed to know what was written beneath this crust. But so the museum had an expert restorer that was on contract. His name was Robert Reddy. He was a former tobacconist. And he was hired by the hour on the days that the museum was opened to the public. But he had to supplement his income with other work. And he had all these different methods to restore these tablets, but he kept them a secret. And he only told them to his four sons. So Reddy alone was the only one who could clean this tablet, but he was away on private business. So Smith's colleague, his name is Wallace Budge. He's becomes a more of a character in this soap opera later when him and Rassom have some battles, and then there's lawsuits and everything. But in any case, he says, Smith was constitutionally a highly nervous, sensitive man, and his irritation with Reddy's absence knew no bounds. Reddy finally returned several excruciating days later and worked his magic, whereupon Smith took the tablet, I'm reading the book quoting what Budge said. Smith took the tablet and began to read over the lines which Reddy had brought to light, and when he saw that they contained the portion of the legend he had hoped to find there, he said, "I am the first man that, after more than 2,000 years of oblivion, has read that." So he sets the tablet on the table. He jumped up and rushed about the room in a great state of excitement, and to the astonishment of those present, he began to undress himself. So that's how excited he was to find this tablet of the, you know, story of Noah written by somebody else. And I mean, that's just one part of the story, as we'll get into it. So I just think that's amazing, modern twist, modern part of the story of finding this epic of Gilgamesh that we're going to talk about today.
I mean, so, like when you read that, like that when he said that he was the first person to read in 2,000 years, I actually got goosebumps.
Because that's great, right?
Imagine being that person who like cracks the code, and you just like, I'm the first one who reads this in 2,000 years. It's pretty amazing.
It is so amazing. And then now after we talk about what this actually that he found was, I mean, it wasn't just that. It's this work of literature, right? I mean, rivals Homer for sure.
And I think like when it was discovered, like the flood story and that bit, like I think like some people actually thought like this is the end of Christianity, because like it was like a huge discovery. that like the Bible that people have been reading for 2,000 years, there's like an earlier version of the pretty much exact same story.
Yep. But belief is a hard thing to crack, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
They still have I believe there's a museum where they explain how Noah brought dinosaur eggs onto the ark. So,
yeah.
You know.
Could be, man. We don't know.
Yeah, hey, what do we know? We weren't there.
Yeah, exactly.
And we were not there. So, yeah, tell us, give us some context about, because the flood myth is really, what is like the 11th tablet of the whole story? So that's just a part of the story, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like one part of the story, and that's like the conversation between Gilgamesh and Utnapishti. But we'll get to that. I'll just give you like a little bit about the background, about the epic, and like, because if you've heard about the epic before, you know that scholars talk about like different versions and
there's different versions and everything. Yeah, let's dig right in.
Yeah, so like the earliest version of the epic date back to as early as the 3rd dynasty of Ur, and that's like 2100 BCE. Those tablets are like they consist of like distinct stories, and it's not like one single epic as we know so like the earliest narrative of one single epic as we know it is the old Babylonian tablets, and those date back to 1800 BCE.
Wait, so basically like for 300 years it was just a story.
I mean, there was...
It was just a story, and then they just kept embellishing on it until it became one big story.
Yeah, exactly. It was, like, many stories about this great king of Uruk. And then, later on, it became, like, one single story.
What that reminds me of? It's like Star Wars or something. You know, you see the first episode, and then another, and then another, and then eventually they weave it into one tale with a backstory and a forward story and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So like,
amazing.
There's two like main versions of the epic, and they're both incomplete, but like fragments of later versions are still like are being used to fill in the gaps.
Okay.
And it's important to notice that fragments and versions of the epic are still being discovered and translated as we speak. So there are like hundreds of thousands of cuneiform tablets laying around in museums across the world waiting to be translated. And of course, most of these consist of like legal documents and so on. But I'm pretty sure that we'll get like more Gilgamesh from these tablets.
That would be good.
Yeah. So,
because there is some, yeah.
Yeah, and there's I think there's around 73 different manuscripts that have been discovered.
Wow.
About Gilgamesh. And there's probably more by now, since my source of information is a little bit old.
Wow.
But I was thinking, we'll focus on the standard Babylonian version in this episode. And that's the one that was found in the library of Ashurbanipal.
Perfect.
Yeah. And
when they found it, it was written in Babylonian and not in Assyrian.
I am actually not sure. And I'm not sure what it's called, the Babylonian version. But yeah, probably it was written in Babylonian.
Yeah. For sure, yeah.
And the standard Babylonian version is the later one. It's the later version of these two complete stories, and it's the best preserved one. And it's thought to have been edited by a Mesopotamian, you can call him scholar or
a scribe maybe.
Yeah, a scribe, and I think they perform some exorcism and.
That too.
And here comes the problem with Akkadian names; they're always a bit complicated, but I think maybe you say his name in this way. Sinleki Unini.
You could do that one.
Something like that, I think.
Sinleki Unini.
Yeah, I think that's a better way of saying
it. Sinleki Unini. Huh. Yeah,
that sounds
good. We'll call him Sam.
Sid, yeah.
Yeah, and he, Sam.
I think he lived between 1300 and 1000 BCE, during like the middle Babylonian period. And okay. His edition was probably based on much older versions.
Yeah, so this is an old story, basically. I mean, yeah. We say Homer was, you know, the story was about maybe 1200 BC, you know, things that happened in the 1200, 1300 BC. Well, this story was, you know, just being, this story was 1,000 years old already then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is as old as is it.
Yeah, as it gets.
Yeah, exactly. I know. So, like, the standard Babylonian version consists of, like, 12 tablets in total. And its name is, like, it goes by the name of its opening words. And the opening words in Akkadian is, excuse me for my Akkadian, Sha Nagba Imuru. And that means basically he who saw the deep, which is describing like the epic's main message, the story of the man who dived into the cosmic sea, or Apsu, which is the Akkadian word for it.
Wow.
And Apsu is like very much a central theme in Mesopotamian mythology, and the name derives from the Sumerian word Absu, which means like the ocean of wisdom.
It's kind of like the universe, maybe, or in my opinion, you know, my opinion, or the Tao.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, so. I mean, it's a, it's like, the Mesopotamian creation myth, Enuma Elish, begins like, when the above, the heavens did not yet exist, nor the earth below. Apsu, the freshwater ocean, was there, the first, the begetter, and Tiamat, the saltwater sea, she who bore them all. They were still mixing their waters, and no pasture land had yet been formed.
They're pretty accurate when you really think about it.
I mean, like, the Bible begins in a similar way, and, like, I think the Tao is, like, similar, like, all of these stories begin with like before there was anything, it was like this thing, and
right, it's just the unknown. Like the Tao is very you know, it just talks about the Tao. You can't understand the Tao.
Yeah,
actually, yeah, so Tao basically starts with, if you think you know the Tao, you don't know the Tao.
Yeah, it's like how does it go? It's like the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao, or something like that.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's right. Right. But it is like a common human, you know, theme to like try to understand.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think like this is a very important thing to bring up about the epic. And I know like many scholars have talked about this, including like Simo Parpola. And he's like a professor in Assyriology. And he's like spent his whole life studying the Epic of Gilgamesh. And he says that like, the epic is like full of like esoteric hidden knowledge that is like there to be understood by the people who study, and
which is why you're mentioning it, is why they say one of the reasons that Ashurbanipal went through the, you know, the his empire, the world at the time, basically to get all the tablets they could, because they wanted to get all that secret knowledge, and Epic of Gilgamesh was a part of it, big part of it.
Exactly. I think they like understood like it was, I'm pretty sure they understood like how important it was to save like all these stories and documents for the future.
Well, he did at that point anyway, for sure.
Yeah. I think he was like way before ahead of his time.
Yeah, I mean that was it's essentially your first official library that's been, you know, for that reason that we know of anyway.
Yeah. And I think like the first museum was by what was the last Babylonian king's name?
Nabonidus.
Yeah, I think he established a museum.
Huh. We're gonna look that one up.
I'm not sure about this one, so yeah. Excuse me if I'm
wrong. We'll check it out.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're just fans of history. We'll find out.
Exactly.
So who's Gilgamesh? Who's this Gilgamesh character anyway?
Well, I'll give you a little bit of like the historical background. So okay. Around 4,700 years ago, that's a very long time, lived a man in southern Mesopotamia who was called Gilgamesh. And the legends about this man lived on for like a very long time, all across the ancient world. And most stories about Gilgamesh are, of course, mythological, but there are many reasons to believe that Gilgamesh was a historical king, as his name is mentioned in the Sumerian king list, as well as in other texts.
All right.
And yeah, if you listen to this podcast before, you've heard about these king lists that the Mesopotamians right. love to write. So Gilgamesh is mentioned as the fifth king of the early dynastic period in a Sumerian city-state called Uruk, which means that he could have lived between 2800 and 2500 BCE.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah, very long time ago. And as you may know, like the ancient Mesopotamians had a profound interest in keeping records, and the Sumerian king list was one of them. It lists like kings and dynasties of Sumer, and as well as like neighboring dynasties and the length of their reign. So, according to the king list, Gilgamesh is said to have ruled Uruk for 126 years.
Oh, 126 years, huh? He's yeah. like a kid compared to some of them in that list, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I think like I think his father, Lugalbanda, I think he ruled for like, I don't know, 1,000 years or something like that.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I wonder when Gilgamesh started ruling. Was his father already 1,000? It's like, yeah, it's anyway.
Yeah, I think his father was, I think he died and then Gilgamesh like took over. But I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So like the kingship in ancient Mesopotamia was thought like to be like a gift from the gods, and the king was thought to be like the intermediator between like gods and his people. So it's very much like a huge responsibility to be king.
Yes, for sure. Especially the time we're talking about. I mean, it's just, it's everything's on the edge of life and death. You know, if you don't have crops, the whole city could die. You have raiders and wars. And I mean, yeah, big job.
Yeah, exactly. And like, the Epic of Gilgamesh is so it's a story of a young and ruthless king. So he's a very oppressive ruler. And according to the legend, Gilgamesh is said to have been like a demigod. So he is two-thirds immortal and one-third divine. And his father, like I said, is said to have been Lugalbanda, and his mother, the goddess Ninsun.
How's that third? I don't understand. I never could quite understand that one, right? They always, I know that they say that, but like if his father was half God and his mother was all God, then wouldn't he be like a quarter?
Yeah, I think that's a bit, it's a bit weird, but two-thirds
But
man.
He's more God than human. I'm yeah, sorry.
Two-thirds God and one, no,
yeah,
two-thirds
he's more
man.
God than he is human.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, well. Anyhow.
Yeah. So, like, in the beginning of the story, Gilgamesh is described as a young and ruthless king, and he forces the men of Uruk to engage in, like, different kinds of games where he beats them and all... he beats them all, and he because he's like bigger and stronger. And on top of that, he forces all the brides to spend their first wedding night with him instead of their husband.
Yeah, and that wasn't that very nice.
Not nice at all, but
no.
So, like, no one dared to oppose or challenge the mighty Gilgamesh, and the people of Uruk prayed to the gods for a change. And so here comes the supreme god, Anu, and he hears the people's prayers and gives the task of creating an equal to Gilgamesh. And the goddess Aruru takes on this task, and she creates the wild man Enkidu out of her.
Ha!
Yeah. this is another interesting thing. She creates him out of her spit and some clay.
Ah.
And I think there's some similarities to the Bible there.
Oh, yeah.
Or, wait, yeah. Am I wrong?
I don't remember how God created Adam, but he created Eve from the rib. He might have created Adam from some clay.
Yeah, I think so, too.
I mean, usually the gods are, all gods are usually creating people out of clay and stuff, so it seems like a common thing.
Yeah.
That's not how you were created, right? From spit and clay?
Spit and clay.
Does anybody ever call you the wild man?
No, nobody knows. No. Everyone's like,
oh, really? Oh, my God.
Like, everyone's like, oh, that's an unusual name. I've never heard it before. And then I have to go like, yeah, it's from the Epic of Gilgamesh. And it's like, yeah. And nobody, like, not many people are very interested.
Oh, well, that's what I tell you. I hope my daughter Lily listens to this. I remember when she was in high school and she had just read had the Epic of Gilgamesh in school. She was learning it and she was very excited about it. I remember she enjoyed it. Maybe it was middle school. I don't remember. But I remember her always commenting on the, you know, Enkidu, the wild man Enkidu.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's a shout out to Lily. But tell us something more. Yeah, tell us some more. I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. So like Enkidu was like, he was made to compete with Gilgamesh. He was like created as an equal.
All right.
And that was like in order to like restore peace to the citizens of Uruk.
Right. They prayed for the gods to the gods, and the gods created Enkidu to calm them down.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, here's a little side note. Like, Enkidu's character was considered to be of a divine essence. And, like, one interpretation of the name Enkidu is that it means, like, the creation of Enki. And Enki was one of the most important gods in the Mesopotamian
pantheon. I see.
And it's not like Enki created Enkidu, but like Enki was the creator of mankind.
I see.
So yeah,
there's a lot of nuance in there that you really, you know, scholars really still probably digging into what all the deep meanings of all of it is from their people of the time.
Yeah, and there's another interpretation of the name, but I've forgotten. But yeah, anyway. So Enkidu didn't know that he was human when he grew up. So he grew up like on the steppes with wild animals and identified himself with the animals. And when the animals were captured in traps and stuff laid out by hunters, he released them from the traps. And so he basically grew up with the gazelles and other animals.
Right.
And but like then comes one day and Hunter manages to spot Enkidu, and one of the, I think it's the hunter's son, he goes to Uruk to tell the great Gilgamesh about what he has seen, as they're troubled by this wild man who ruins their hunt.
Yeah, right. Like he's in the woods, he runs with the gazelles and antelopes, and when he sees something caught in a trap, he goes and lets them go, right? So yeah, it was like the hunter's, the kid, the hunter's son, or he sees him releasing him, and he's afraid of him, right? So then he goes to his dad, father, and his father says, go see Gilgamesh, he'll help you.
Yeah, exactly. And
then what happens?
So Gilgamesh gets, they go to Gilgamesh and they tell him, like, oh, we've seen this man, and he's, like, stronger than everyone else, and blah, 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 blah. And then Gilgamesh, like, orders the hunter to return to the steppes, but this time he should be accompanied by a prostitute named Shamhat. And she's going to seduce Enkidu and bring him back to Uruk.
Uh-huh. How'd that work out?
Well...
Oh, darn. I'm going to have to end it right there. But don't worry. We'll be back with more of our favorite fan, Enkidu the Wild Man. And I will leave you with a little bit of Lily.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just a dollar an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.